And welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of November 8th, 2019. Today we are delighted, pleased, happy, and relieved to have back with us the esteemed co-host of our show, Ms. Mariah Tinger. How are you doing, Mariah?
I'm well, happy to be back.
That's good, that's good. But you do have a little cough, so if you cough a bit, people should give you a pass, right?
Oh, I hope so.
Mariah, the past few weeks have seemed like climate apocalypse out in, or maybe just plain old apocalypse out in California, with wildfires threatening homes lost, and this is getting to be a story we've heard many times, right? But in the last this year. Particularly about a month ago, and then a repeat this past week, the utility in California, Pacific Gas and Electric, was made the choice to turn off electricity distribution to large swaths of the population in order to prevent wildfires starting from their equipment, for which it turns out PG&E is totally financially responsible for any fires that start, as a quirk of California law. So they're turning off the power and basically turning California into a third world country. I mean, you must have seen some of the clips on TV of these hellscapes of people driving down the I-5 and with fire by the Getty Museum and things like that, right?
Yeah, and like people who, you know, they have medical needs that are dependent on having electricity, and all of a sudden they don't have that electricity. And
it's really
problematic.
It's a big problem. And of course, just to add to the amusement, the President of the United States is tweeting out mad king tweets about denying California any money for all of this. But we talked about these fires before and have pointed out that climate is an important component, because climate change has dried out the areas of California. Hot and dry weather are a accelerant, shall we say, of climate change. But given that we're back in the soup here, again, with a second round of power outages in California, deliberate power outages, we have to start to wonder, what's the future? Is this the new normal? Is California, I've seen articles that talk about, ask whether or not California is a viable concern anymore, right? If every fall there's going to be basically, you know, Baghdad style power every from 4 to 8 every day kind of thing. I mean, that's just not a tenable place for modern society. I read an interesting article by a guy named Dave Roberts at Vox Magazine. We've quoted this guy, Dave Roberts, before. Very, very thorough, thoughtful guy. And he's put up some ways to kind of order our thinking, and I guess I wanted to step through some of that stuff. He makes the case that the situation in California is perhaps not as simple. It's not just climate. Let's say that. And he proposes several different reasons why these fire events are so impactful. Of course, one is that climate change is real, and that the land out in California is drier, hotter, just more prone to fire. Boom. Full stop. Right. So that's a given. That's what I guess Dave Roberts and other things would call the distal cause. Right. This is the baseline at which things are now operating, is a hot, dry environment. But there's other things. One is that Pacific Gas and Electric has, you know, deliberately mismanaged. Deliberate mismanagement is an oxymoron, right? Mismanaged keeping the conditions clear around some of the places that could start fires, right? There's trees and there's brush that they could have been more aggressive. They could have put in modern equipment. They may have not done as much as they could to keep their infrastructure up to par. I suppose that's in keeping with the fact that PG&E is what's called a investor-owned utility, an IOU, if you've never heard that acronym before, an IOU, right? This whole thing is for profit, for investors. So that's kind of a backdrop that you have to keep in mind, that, you know, with PG&E, everything that they do has a profit motive, right? And that's colors all the choices that are made. Anyway, so PG&E has its issues. I don't know if they spent their money wisely, Mariah, if there's any or not, but there's that question.
Right.
The other thing that's important that Roberts points out that's important to think about is something called the wilderness-urban interface. Right? So that's a fancy way of saying that people have their houses out in the woods where they're more prone to be burned down because they're just farther from facilities. They're not dense. And he says that this increase in the number of homes that are exposed is twofold. I mean, one, you get your crazy movie star that wants to build on a mountaintop someplace. And God knows, I don't know if you've ever been in driving up the Malibu coast. I mean, there's all these houses perched on, you think would just fall into the ocean, right? But it's also right. that the housing prices in California are so astronomically high that people have to search for less expensive options. And that often puts you out in the middle of nowhere. Right. So now maybe you're in a trailer home in some place out in the woods. At least you get to be in California, but you're exposed in this wilderness urban interface where you're more likely to be burned up when a fire comes along. So Roberts points out that, yeah, part of the issue out there is a public policy issue where, you know, the housing costs drive some of the damage. It's an interesting way of thinking about it. I hadn't really thought about it that much that way before. And the fourth thing that I think is interesting that he talks about is that the utility model is outmoded. It just doesn't fit the 21st century. And I think that's probably a place that is useful for us to think about, because I think the same is true here in Massachusetts. Here in Massachusetts, all the utilities are investor-owned, right? They're all driven by a profit motive, and that gets you into questions: is the profit motive really serving the needs of people as effectively as you could do it in other ways, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean,
I heard two things about the, and I don't know which of these is trying to follow up too much on them, but that the some people say that part of the reason PG&E was not managing the infrastructure well, was not doing the upgrades they should have, was because they were spending a lot of money on renewable energy, right? And they were directing a lot of funds towards that. Kudos to them, but maybe they were letting the infrastructure slide, which caused a lot of, you know, was the reason for a lot of the fires. But then somebody else said, well, actually, it's because they were making sure the shareholders got a good profit at the expense of upgrading the infrastructure. So again, I don't know which of those is, you know, the true story, and who knows if we ever will know. But
well, as all these things, I think there's a huge amount of, no one's hands are clean, probably, right? It's very hard to find a single clear villain, right? A guy with a black mustache and a tall stovepipe hat, right? That you can say he's the bad guy. But yes, I mean the. Well, the let me talk for a minute about the utility model, okay? And this is utilities are the most fascinating topic in the world. I'm sure everyone listening just wants to hear everything they can about utilities, right? You want to hear a whole long several hours. You just
tell
go on
more.
And on. Tell me more about utilities. Well, the very very brief. And this may be the tweet of utility history is that they are. Monopolies, granted monopolies that were granted at the beginning of the 20th century, that is to say 1910, 1919, they were monopolies granted to companies who could then most efficiently build electrification infrastructure, that is to say, to build high voltage cables and wires to get electricity to people. Because in 1919, that was the need. Right, that was the requirement, was to get electricity to people, and if that electricity was made in a single plant, and we just needed to build wires out, and I mean that kind of model went on for a long time. Even in the 1930s, the Tennessee Valley Authority, right, was basically formed by in the original New Deal to use hydroelectric power to provide electricity to the Tennessee Valley, which is this huge humanitarian breakthrough, right? So fine. And as far as all that goes, the utility model worked well for the purposes it was built for, which was to create an infrastructure to serve the public in the 1910s, 20s, 30s. The problem now is that we're no longer in the 1919, we're now 2019, and the model that says the main goal of the utility is to build stuff and get paid for building stuff. And that's another interesting fact here, is that one of the big drivers for PG&E and, of course, for utilities here in Massachusetts is that they get paid for making investments. They get a return on, they get this guaranteed like 14% when they build something. And so they have an incentive to build stuff, right? And that's just out of line with where the energy economy is right now. Because nowadays, the energy economy has moved to the place we have something called distributed generation. You have solar panels on people's roofs. You have, you know, people that can put up wind turbines and a whole different model. We've said it before, but it's kind of the equivalent of Uber in a taxi company, right? It's just different models of how to provide electricity. And what
to clarify, they do not get that same 14% return on investment if they upgrade infrastructure, right? This is only if they build new infrastructure.
I believe it's building new infrastructure. And here in Massachusetts, okay. I think, for example, the Enbridge pipeline upgrade, they get, I think it's 14% back on that investment, right? Mm-hmm. And so they darn sure and certain want to build that pipeline because they're going to get a lot of money back on it, right? And they have to justify it and tell us all. We'll come back to the pipelines in Massachusetts later. But yeah, there's this. And of course, I can't say that I know everything about this. So it's my understanding that it's this new infrastructure. That's the incentivization for the utility, right? Because that's what they wanted in 1920, right? But nowadays, you have ideas about microgrids, which are sort of enclosed areas. Like a hospital could be a microgrid where there's some power coming in, or you generate some power in the hospital to keep it alive. And then if the power outside collapses, the hospital still has its lights on, right? So the concept of a microgrid is very interesting, completely foreign to the 1920 model of utilities, but is something that would have many benefits because, for example, in California, if you built a system that had microgrids, they could protect themselves. That is to say, when PG&E needs to turn down the main power because there's going to be fires overnight, certain areas within this within their own microgrids could protect themselves by keeping their own power on, right? And I think it's also true that you have less high voltage power running around on transmission lines, which seems to me a source of starting fires as well. So we're now pretty far afield from the immediate cause of fires, but the question is how are we going to deal with this kind of stuff over the next 20 or 30 years is important. And his argument is that the real important thing is to get the utility and align the utility with the incentives that we want as a society. So, and then just to take that one step farther and bring it kind of back to things that are happening here in Massachusetts is that there's this concept of community choice aggregation. And I say that that's something that we have here in Massachusetts. It's an option that cities and towns can take. So there are certain towns in Massachusetts that have that are able to buy. And, of course, the town can buy all the power because of this whole question of deregulation, which is another deep, dark kind of topic. But a city like Boston, and Boston's already doing this, can buy all the power for the citizens of Boston, right? And everybody in Boston still pays, it's invisible to the people in Boston because they still pay the same bills, but the city of Boston has purchased that power, and then the city of Boston or any other community in Massachusetts can begin to increase the amount of renewable energy that is required in that power. Right? And, of course, it's balance of cost and all kinds of things. But a community choice aggregation model is that concept, that a town can purchase its own power. And what Dave Roberts from Vox argues is that in California, the reform of the utility, the reformation of the utility system would be to create more clear-cut equivalence of community choice aggregation so that different places would have a local utility that was aligned with their own needs, right? In California, you have people that are out in the woods that have, you have other people on the coast, people in the mountains. There's all different kinds of conditions. And that if there was a power provider that was closer to the towns and the cities, that could be better tailored, and the community choice aggregation model is close enough. Hey, Mariah, wake up! I see you're falling asleep.
Well, so my question, I know that this is a little bit different, but I did hear something about the publicly owned cooperative. Like there's I don't know, maybe 20 mayors, I think, or something like that in California they're trying to figure out what to do with PG&E now. And they're arguing that it should be turned over to public ownership and make it a cooperative of some sort. And I know that's different than community choice aggregation. Would those two go together? Is this what Dave Roberts is responding to in his article? Do you know the association between those two different ideas?
Well, I think that it is slightly different. So there is an argument in California right now that says that the public should take over PG&E. The state of California should take over PG&E. I think that's pretty much what you're saying.
The publicly owned co-op is.
Yeah, right. Is that the government should basically, in the name of the people of California, take over PG&E. Robert's argument is that if you do that, then all of the bad things associated with the current system automatically sit on the head of the government of California. Right. So all of the mismanagement, all of the blackouts, all of the fires and all this kind of stuff becomes responsibility of the state of California. Right.
And even though
the taxpayers, even though they didn't create it, you know, but they will, in quote unquote, own it responsibility wise. And that's probably unwise. I think that the just politically. Right. I think that if you talk about public ownership in a way that allows the state of California to radically revamp the incentives for a utility like PG&E, so you can now align the incentives and where PG&E wants to spend money, can align that with the public good. I think the public good means fight climate, don't allow forest fires to burn down houses, keep people's power on as much as possible. If you have a way to align those things, then probably public ownership is a reasonably good idea. But just taking over all the responsibility is not a good idea. And I think the example, Mariah, I would say, is that here in Massachusetts, we're having serious troubles with the MBTA, the train system, right? MBTA has run out of money. And one of the reasons the MBTA has run out of money is that the state legislature took all of the costs of the big dig, right? The Tip O'Neill Tunnel, $15 billion or something. It took all that and dropped it on top of the MBTA and said, you are now responsible for paying all this off. So that's just one of the sort of financial catastrophes that's fallen the MBTA. I think something similar would happen if you took all of PG&E's problem and dropped them on the state of California. I think Robert says one way to hand the state back to the Republican Party from the Democrats would be to make the state government own the PG&E problem, right?
Don't because say that too bad.
Yeah, well, it's a bad. So I think that to your point, I think public ownership is good if it is empowered to align the incentives for the corporation of the utility, right? Whatever that is. But anyway, so one final idea here. One other idea to keep in mind is that this thing we're seeing happen in California, everyone has known about for the last 15 to 20 years, right? Everyone knows that climate change is going to make these problems worse, and still we're shocked and surprised by the fact that we have this big issue, right? And you look around and say, okay, I wonder what other places were going to be shocked and surprised by climate-related issues. And it just tells you how basically unprepared our society has been for the coming turbulence from climate change. I mean, it's just a thing to think about a little bit. So, there you go, Mariah. That's everything I know about utilities in 20 minutes.
Exciting stuff.
Exciting stuff.
It
For
is.
those for those two listeners still with us, I know you're out there. Thank
It
you for hanging in there to this
is.
point. What we'll do is put up links to the blog, links to the Robert's article, etc. at the blog. It's at massclimateaction.org/blog. You can find us on Facebook at /massclimateaction. And of course, we want to point out that everything we say on the show is the opinion of the speakers and not of the Massachusetts Climate Action Network. We want to thank DR Tucker. I keep saying DR Roberts. Nah, DR Tucker is almost as good as DR Roberts. DR Tucker, thank you so much for your continuing research support. I want to ask if you've got a question or a comment, please send us an email to podcast@massclimateaction.net. That's an email, podcast@massclimateaction.net. You can listen to us directly on your smartphone using Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, all those common podcast distribution apps. Let me say one other thing, Mariah, before I forget it. In Massachusetts, the legislative session for 2019 is winding down in November. As far as I know, there will be two more Senate sessions scheduled on the 12th and the 14th. Now, it's a little bit hazy because the schedules are pretty fluid for the Massachusetts Senate. But if you can get yourself into Boston and you put on your climate T-shirt, you can, in fact, sit in the gallery of the Massachusetts Senate and observe the proceedings. And if you're polite, but you have a blazing yellow climate shirt on, the senators down below will notice you, trust me. And it's a good message to the senators that climate change matters to people. So if you can make it, 12th or the 14th, please get into Boston and get up in the gallery. It's a civics lesson anyway. Mariah, have you ever taken the tour of the State House? I mean,
A
it's
long time
long
ago, a
time.
long time
I
ago.
remember a long time ago taking the tour and being in the Senate. This is probably, God knows, 50 years ago. But it's a civics lesson. And you say, holy mackerel, this is where these guys work. So anyway, I highly recommend you do that. And we'll close where we always close by saying that we recognize the necessity of personal accountability, that we accept responsibility for building a durable future, that we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out. Because of this, we have to insist that the United States transform its energy sector over the next decade under a just and equitable plan that uses regulation, investment, and a price on carbon to safeguard our future. So, Mariah, it's been great to have you back.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
Thanks everyone for listening. We'll talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.
Very cool.